Hey everyone, welcome to another Baseball America podcast. With executive editor JJ Cooper, I'm Josh Norris, and we're going to talk today about the rule changes that were enacted throughout the minor leagues. It was yesterday when they dropped, and there's rule changes that some may be familiar with. If you followed what was supposed to happen in the Atlantic League, or what did happen in the Atlantic League in 2019, the Arizona Fall League in 2019, and some other stuff that was slated to happen in 2020, if 2020 happened. So it shouldn't be entirely new, but there was some other stuff that is less familiar to people who pay attention. And we're going to go over them today and kind of give our reaction to them. What do you think, JJ?
Man, people do love to absolutely get mad on social media about rules changes, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even if you know, half of social media is, you know, there's too many home runs, there's too many strikeouts, there's too many walks. Well, and the shift is ruining baseball. Well, we're going to kind of mitigate the shift here at AA or try that, or we're going to, you know, change the rules so stolen bases are more prevalent, and we're still going to get mad. You could put money on every seat of every person in the house, and somehow that would be a bad thing.
Well, and again, I don't mind. You know, fans can have their opinions. You know, we appreciate that. That's why you come to baseballamerica.com. But at the same time, my initial reaction on this is, having seen most of these rules in some way, shape, or form in the Atlantic League, a couple of years ago, I went to sat on a High Point Rockers series so that I could kind of see many of these rules in place. Atlantic League in 2019 had the larger bases. Atlantic League in 2019 had the step-off rule. Atlantic League in 2019 had the automatic ball strike system, which you probably know as robo-umps. So those are all things, and they also had some of these pace of game rules as well. All of those things were in place in the Atlantic League. And the best way that I can explain it is, and I think I wrote about this at the time, was you got about 4 or 5 innings in, and most of these just kind of faded into the background. AAA is going to have larger bases. The bases go from 15 by 15 to 18 by 18. Well, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that the average fan going to a game will never notice that difference.
If they had not released this info, nobody would have noticed. Maybe someone would have caught on with, you know, hey, the times from home to first and first to second are getting just a tick quicker these days, and maybe someone would have figured that out. But if they hadn't released this yesterday and they'd just done this kind of covertly, nobody would have noticed.
And when I asked, players in the Atlantic League, coaches, so what did you notice about, what do you think about the bases? Basically, the only real change that seemed to come from it was his first baseman liked the fact that they had more base to stay away from the spikes of a base runner. That's the difference. Now, yes, it does mean that home to first is 3 inches shorter. Same for first to second, you know, all that, right?
Yeah, 89.
First to second is, I guess, is 6 inches shorter because you have 3 inches for each base. Yeah.
89 and a half feet.
Right. Well, but it's really, but that's not accurate, because 90 feet was from, I believe, the midpoint of the bag before, correct? You're our umpire guy.
Yeah, I'm not our field dimensions guy.
You know, but my point being, it's a very, very, very small difference. The biggest thing that it did seem to do is that you have a little bit more room at first base. I know that the hope is that it will increase stolen base success rates and ground ball and bunt rates. It's so negligible as to not going to really affect on that, I don't think. You know, AA, we have that, as you said, I would say that's probably of all these, surprising is probably not the right word, but everyone listening to this knows what we're talking about. The rule in AA is going to be you have to have 4 players on the infield, each of whom must have both feet completely in front of the outer boundary of the infield dirt. So 4 infielders, and I say 4 players, but I assume that they're not counting the pitcher on there. You know, they're saying four players in the infield and you all have to be in the dirt, which is a pretty dramatic change. And they're saying there's the possibility that they may require you to have two infielders on either side of the second base in the second half of the season. They haven't determined that yet. But having seen a lot of second baseman play in short right field, that's going to be a pretty significant difference. That's going to absolutely be something I would say probably the most noticeable of these changes compared to recent years, because we have seen now a lot of shifting in the minor leagues like we do in the majors. But that said, you know, it's an experiment. We'll see what happens with it. But, I personally just don't get that outraged about stuff like this. I will be interested to see what that means. What are your thoughts on that one, Josh?
Yeah, and I'm similar to you. Like, I'm not outraged by any of these. As a matter of fact, as it so happened, we're going to get to this rule a little later, but the step-off rule at high A, and one of the things I was thinking about on my drive into work yesterday was how much I dislike watching pickoffs and how something that works so infinitesimally is done so often and does lead to the slowdown of the game. And I get the idea of keeping guys close via the pickoff, but it's certainly an exercise in tedium over and over and over again. And then out of the sky, completely unbeknownst to me, is this rule where you get two per plate appearance. And if you try a third and you don't get him, that's a balk. But anyway, back to the other stuff, you know, I'm not really going to get up in arms over any of this. Like, I'm not a fan of eliminating the shift. I like the idea of the strategy, involved in coming up with these shifts. But I understand I don't see baseball the same way as a lot of fans do. I'm completely, detached from any one team as a favorite. And I kind of watch games, to see this, that, and the other prospect. So it's not about the horse race to me. And, my team, air quotes, is not going to be cost a hit or a run or a win or a loss because of shifts. So, my perspective is a little different than everybody else's. And I can understand kind of why everyone's so up in arms. But the fact that we do this on every rule change, that it's killing baseball and it's tiresome. But yeah, I'm with you, JJ. It's just another thing to kind of notice, like with the extra inning rule, the international tiebreaker rule that you saw in the minors in 2019. The only time I ever really noticed it was the one time it saved me from getting my cameras rained on because the game ended before the storms came, and every other time I just have to remember that the rule is in place. I say, how the heck did that runner get on second base? And they'll say, oh yeah, extra innings, that makes sense. But other than that, it doesn't really take away from my enjoyment of the game.
Well, so I think a key thing to note here, and again, when MLB announced this, they announced this as experimental playing rules. The key thing to note is there is a methodicalness to having each of these different levels have different rules. So it's not apples to apples. If you wanted apples to apples, one double A league would do one, and one would do another maybe, because you have different levels and all. But having double A have a shift rule of some sort, but the rest of the minors not, essentially creates a control for you in some way, where you're going to be able to, MLB is going to be able to see, does this create more balls in play? Now here's the thing. Here's the overarching thing I'll say with this is, I don't think it'll make that much difference. And here's why. You can try to change in modest ways the calculus for bunts, for infield hits, for stolen bases, for shifts to have a little bit higher batting average on balls in play. If the strikeout rate remains at the rate it currently is, the balance of, am I better off trying to hit a homer, or am I better off trying to sacrifice power to increase contact? Right now, it's very, very heavily in favor of swinging for the fences. a much more efficient way to score runs for most teams right now is by hitting homers rather than trying to string together a rally. And I don't think that any of these changes here are going to be sufficient to change that. But at the same time, we will see how much this does. And these are experiments. We get down to high A. High A has the step-off rule, which was in the Atlantic League. Basically, it says you have to disengage the rubber before throwing to any base. If not, it is a balk. Really what this does, if you're a right-handed pitcher, this is not that important to you. If you are a left-handed pitcher, it is, because it ends, Julio Urias should be glad that he is not in high A, because, and Andy Pettit years ago and all, there, that lefty move where you hang on your balance, on your back foot, and then you land somewhere in that 45 degree angle between going home and going to first and throw over and hopefully pick off a batter. You can't do that anymore with this rule. It also takes away the inside play, at second base. You have to step off the base before you start to throw over. Well, what we saw in the Atlantic League with this is two main things, I would say. One, we did see more steals. Stolen base rate went up significantly. And two, talking to players who were dealing with this rule, it made double plays less likely. Because if you are on first, you should be able with this to get a good enough lead that it makes it less likely that you're going to be, caught on a double play, at second base. You should be able to get a really good lead. Those are modest changes in the grand scheme of thing, because again, the stolen base rate overall still was very modest compared to what it would have been like decades ago. But it's something where having it only in high A means, okay, let's look at what low A stolen base rate is compared to high A, and maybe you'll see a significant difference. That'll be an answer on that. Then you go to low A, and as you said, low A is going to have the total of two, step-offs, pick-offs per plate appearance. If you do a third and it doesn't work, then it's a balk. And then they may drop it to one. Well, I'll tell you right now, the limitation as it stands right now means you're largely going to drop it to one right now. Because if I've got a chance to do two of something freely without any limitation, I kind of want the threat of that second pickoff. Because once I've made two pickoffs, the third one is something where he literally better be a base runner is standing somewhere almost halfway to second base before I throw over. So I'm probably going to keep that second one in my back pocket, but this is a rule that I think will have much more impact if it went to college baseball than it went to pros, because there are a lot more throwovers in college baseball, I think, than there are in pros. But my sense is, again, with that, it's not going to be a particularly dramatic one. But at the same time, I do agree with you. I don't particularly get a big thrill out of watching a pitcher throw over to first.
No, it's, for my money, the worst on-field part of the game outside of maybe beanball brawls. I also hope that if you're going to kind of encourage runners this way to take slightly bigger leads, we do get more back picks. I do like catcher back picks. Those are very fun, since they don't happen every two or three pitches, it seems like. And when you get them, you get to see, a Yadi Molina kind of exhibit some of his best qualities. Like, that's a really fun play that doesn't happen that often. And it kind of shows some of the top catchers in the game it shows what they can do. And that's really fun. I don't know how you feel about that, JJ, but that would be like a little bit of a very small added bonus for me.
So I don't mind back picks. They're fun. I agree with you on that. Like,
If you did them every two pitches, it'd be like, oh, yeah, what are we doing here?
If you start seeing catchers do that every two pitches, something's going wrong.
Or with the frequency with which regular pickoffs happen. Right. I mean, also, before we go forward, we need to take time for a word from our sponsor. So going through this, I don't think there's anything crazy, but We are coming back. We've talked about the pickoff limitations, the step off rule, defensive positionings, and now we come to robo umps, which were in play in the Arizona Fall League in 2019 and are going to be in the Low A Southeast League, aka the league formerly known as the Florida State League, in 2021. I don't know how you feel about the automatic ball strike system, as it's formerly called, JJ. So what are your thoughts?
So when we saw this in the Atlantic League, this is absolutely positively to me the biggest of all of these changes. And the reason I say that is, and this is where this gets difficult because this is an experimental playing rule. Every other one of these rules that we are talking about, I think will have a very modest effect on development. I don't think that's true with this. This absolutely positively benefits certain types of pitchers over others.
And it hamstrings certain dimensions of hitters.
Well, when in the Atlantic League, talking again, players, coaches, and all who experienced this, what stood out, the strike zone with the automatic ball strike system, which, let me make clear, one thing about an automatic ball strike system, robo umps, whatever you want to call it, and I've written about this before, I'll try to link to this in our story here, the strike zone becomes what you want it to be. And there are some tricky parts with that. This is why you want to have experiments. But in the Atlantic League, when this was implemented, the strike zone became much more north-south and much less east-west. Well, so who does that benefit? Well, actually, maybe this is good from a development standpoint. It benefits pitchers who are pitching the way that MLB teams are kind of looking for right now.
Nailed
it. If you are throwing fastballs up in the zone, if you're pitching up, down, fastballs up, a curveball that, you know, that you also throw kind of a 12 to 6, 11 to 5, you know, 1 to 7, I don't want to discriminate against lefties. If you're throwing that kind of those kind of pitches, you'll love this strike zone. You will find very quickly low A Southeast hitters will learn, oh, that pitch at the top is now in the zone. Okay, well, that's something I need to know because that's a harder pitch for me to hit, but I'm going to now have to adjust to that being a strike.
With the velocity in today's game, I think those pitches at the top of the zone are unhittable as is. So if you're throwing 98 at the top of the zone and you try to swing through it, you're probably not going to get to it. Now, if it's a called strike, you're in real trouble.
I'm going to argue with you. It depends on what your swing path is like.
For as long as I've watched baseball, I've always seen the fastball, you know, nipple high be almost untouchable. And every so often you get it. And especially with, you know, the way the velocity has increased since I've been watching baseball for 26 years now, I don't think there's a whole lot of guys that have a lot of success at the top of that zone.
Oh, it's a very effective pitch. I agree with you on that.
It's an incredibly effective pitch. But now if you're having it called and you in days without automatic ball strike, you can lay off of it. That's your weapon. But now if you have to swing at it, I don't think it's going to be a very good time for hitters. Now, if you also want to talk about the type of hitter that's going to be affected by this, the very tall hitter, they're going to have a strike zone that is gigantic.
Well, no. But okay, so this is what I'm saying. This is where the experiment comes in. That is effectively one of the things that we learned when this came in the Atlantic League. There were some batters who, and this is the things that you have to work out, there were some batters whose strike zones were probably a little bit off for what they are. Like, you're right when you say, like, what they did in the Atlantic League is they tried to draw a strike zone based on the height of the player. Now, I will say, to me, if you are going to an automatic ball strike system, at some point, to me, you actually go to you change the rule. You have a fixed strike zone. Whether you're, to me, again, this is, if I'm experimenting, I don't care if you're 6'8 or you're 5'2. Here's the box. If you throw it in that box, it's a strike. But you are right. But one of the things they learned is that some batters, you could have 2 6'5" batters with seemingly similar stances, and one of them strike zone would seem to be taller than the other. And there wasn't a whole lot of transparency on that at the point of why that was the case. But that's a potential hurdle that you're going to see in the FSL. But you are right. If the taller you are, the more, you know, if you follow the definition of the rule book strike zone, it's going to be a big zone, a bigger zone than they've ever been used to.
And that's the next point, is if you follow the definition of the strike zone, oh man, strikeouts are going, I think, to go through the roof. Even more so than they already are. Because you're talking about the way the book is written, and I think the answer is to change the way the book is written.
Yes.
Any part of the ball touches any part of the zone, that's a strike. And if, in theory, first of all, 12-6 curveballs are going to be extraordinarily valuable under this system. Because in theory, it's where you break the front. Imagine the front of home plate extends up as a pane of glass. It's where you break that pane of glass. So in theory, you can land a ball on home plate, and that's a strike. We saw balls in the Arizona Fall League, especially when I got to the video and took a look from the side, where the catcher had to go into your kind of five-hole block to block it, and that's a called strike. And the beauty of that is nobody knows who to argue with on that. And we did see a guy get ejected. I think it was Jalen Miller arguing with the robo ump.
Are ejected.
Basically, yeah. It does give the umpire some discretion on some of these calls, but you'd have to be, you know, really sure. Like a ball like bounces through the zone somehow, and it registers as a strike. I think the move north-south is not going to be enough to mitigate the lack of an east-west strike zone, and you are going to see a lot of called third strikes. And a lot of guys trying to fish knowing that they're going to be called third strikes necessarily. I think it's a thing that people have wanted for a long time when they see kind of an Eric Gregg type scenario or an Angel Hernandez type scenario where the strike zone seems all out of whack, but I don't think you want the real strike zone. You don't know what it looks like.
But this is, again, this is, to me, the answer to this long-term is, this is where the strike zone is what you want to make it. And like what you just talked about there are four different ways to me that you can envision the strike zone. One is that you can envision the strike zone as a pane of glass. Imagine like a pane of glass at the front of the plate. And you say, if it crosses through this, it's a strike. Two is you can view it as the same thing at the back of the plate. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense there because the back of the plate is at a point. So let's throw that one out. Three.
I always thought the answer to that is just to turn the plate around.
Right. But three is to say, envision it actually as an actual box with depth, which makes a much bigger strike zone even, you know, where if you cross over in any point of this, it's a strike. But four, and this is the answer to me, the strike zone ends up being a box at the midpoint of the plate. That is the logical long-term. If you have the precision of a visual system that is able to tell exactly where the pitch is, to me, you look at the midpoint of the plate. And that means that you avoid the 12-6 curveball that can almost hit the back of the plate, but still have crossed through the bottom of the zone. You also avoid that curveball, that slider that, again, if you talked about it as a box with depth, the one that just ticks a little spot on a corner or the top or the bottom at some point, but just say the midpoint. That's the, you know, to me, if you did that, to me, if you, again, long-term, if we are headed this way, if you said a midpoint of the plate, here's the box. And by the way, again, I would say that also, and just build it to be a fixed dimension, that Jose Altuve's strike zone and Aaron Judge's strike zone under this new system are the same. I think that's the best way to do this. Now, there's another component of this that is a little messier, which is from a developmental standpoint. I think understandably most people seeing this, you know, the casual fan doesn't follow this that much, but major league umpires come from the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I don't have a good answer for you right now, this absolutely, positively, with if you don't figure out ways to make adjustments for this, it puts low A Southeast umpires at a disadvantage in their development when compared to every other low A league. Because if I'm not getting a chance to call ball strikes, but these other leagues umpires, the league umpires in the other leagues are, well, how am I being evaluated to move up? Because minor league umpires are being evaluated just like minor league players. Some of them move up, some of them don't. And right now, again, there are ways you can do this to me that could mitigate it, but they're not easy. One of them, which is say that, okay, your umpires are going to be low A Southeast for part of the year, and then they're going to rotate to another league, and then you're going to bring in umpires from one of the other leagues. You're going to rotate them through so that everyone kind of shares this experimental burden of, you know, loss of development time. But that's a hurdle. The other thing that I think is key for people to note here is, you know, there's all the talk about our Robo Umps coming to the majors. Well, right now we're talking about one league at one level in the minors having automated ball strike. That's not going to make a whole lot of impact yet. But if 3 years from now, Class A and Class AA, let's say, are automated ball strike, at that point, the decision long-term is made. And I tee you up on this because you understand umpiring. You have umpired. I have not the way you have. Mm-hmm. But if your Class A, down the road, if your Class A umpires at low A and high A aren't calling balls and strikes, you essentially have stopped the development of those umpires being trying to pick that up at double A and triple A or whatever level. You've kind of cut off the developmental pipeline at that point, I would argue. And at that point, you've made the decision, the long-term decision, kind of a fait accompli.
Yeah, I think the other way to kind of mitigate it, if possible, is to take those umpires who are going to be in Florida and cycle them back and forth, if possible, between extended and the GCL and the low A Southeast League. So you get live strikes and balls and automatic strikes and balls. You get a mix a little bit, just kind of like you would cycle essentially sometimes GCL players back and forth to the FSL if you need a body or two. That's one way to do it. But I do worry about, a sense of strike zone awareness kind of stagnating for those guys and then having to kind of wake back up if and when you get a promotion.
You say guys, I will note also men and women.
Yes, men and women. I'm just using the colloquial guys, but yeah, I don't know what levels those other two or three of them are going to be at. But once they move up, I wonder if their sense of strike zone awareness is going to be rusty and they'll make some horrendous calls because they've gotten used to just kind of sitting back there and watching for balks and foul tips and plays at the plate and fair foul down the line, all sorts of things like that.
I'm not even calling it rusty. I mean, go a step beyond this. The typical path of a minor league umpire is someone who relatively lower levels of the minors is an umpire who relatively recently went to umpire school.
Yes.
And now, I mean, this is one of the things like, you know, when you look at, you know, you have local umpires who help out sometimes, who often have a lot more experience than the actual professional minor league umpires do, because if you're someone who's been working college games and all in your area and high school games for years, that the minor league umpire, you know, in the lower levels is usually a little younger. Those are thousands and thousands of pitches that you simply aren't getting. And again, you can say, I'm going to bear down on them just like if I was calling balls and strikes, not the same thing.
But I will also say, and I'm kind of freestyling here, if you are one of those umps at that level, you can make the decision essentially to not take those pitches off. You're not going to call them. You're going to, you know, you're going to listen to what your earpiece says. But in watching and listening to what the earpiece says, maybe you kind of fix your own strike zone and learn how to better call the auto zone yourself. And you have, and you can bring that auto zone with you. This isn't a spot for auto zone to the next level. And maybe that way your umps start to get more consistent in their strike zones. You create a more an automated zone within a human when they bring them to double or a pie.
I think that may be the intent, but again, I'm just going to say, if you're not calling balls and strikes regularly, and then you get asked to do it at a higher level, that's going to be a very difficult role to do.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't know how. I can't even imagine having, you know, the voice of whoever in my ear telling me ball strike. Or I also can't wait for the game that is delayed by buffering, quite frankly.
I've seen this. I've been there for that. And basically, that's coming, yeah. No, but there is a rule that you have a very short period of time. And if the technical problems cannot be sorted out pretty quickly, you just dump the auto strike system for that inning. You know, and by the way, it's for the inning is the key point with that also. Like, it's not for the half inning. Let's say that in the top of the second, the automated ball strike goes out. You don't say, hey, we got it working good for the bottom of the inning. Nope. Both teams are going to play under the same rules for that inning. And then the inning after that is when you will go back to using the automated ball strike.
That's good too. I was, my paranoia also kind of led me to a scenario where some nefarious team hacks ABS and does things that are, to their advantage, but that's just me being a little paranoid about how the strike zone might work. In any case, yeah, there's going to be a lot of weird variables to the automatic ball strike system. And I think it's going to be the biggest and most influential thing that we got out of the rules dump that we had yesterday. Do we have any others that we need to touch on?
I think there's another potentially significant one here, which is in low A West, on-field timers, one in the outfield, two behind home plate between the dugouts, will be implemented to enforce time limits between delivery of pitches, inning breaks, and pitching changes. The on-field timer will include new regulations beyond the system currently used in AAA and AA to reduce game length and improve pace of play. Well, so when they say timers, so we're going to have clocks like we have in AA and AAA and have for a long time. Here's the interesting part about that to me is that we don't know what those new rules and regulations will be. But the biggest thing is, the open secret is you have very rarely seen the timer enforced in AA and AAA. It became less and less enforced over the past few years. Is this going to be something that is very closely enforced in low A, or is it something that's going to be... Even the presence of it has made a difference in AA, AAA, even if it's not always enforced, because it kind of keeps everyone within a new normal, I guess is the way I'd say. You go to as many, if you go to more games than I do, I should say. Yes. So with that, what are your thoughts, having been to many a game where a pitch clock in AA or AAA was technically part of the game?
One, you don't notice it. Not often. It's there. It's not well enforced, I don't think. And if I remember correctly, there are ways around it too. Like, I think the rule is you have to be set by a certain time. And then once you get there, you can just hold your set for however long. I think Chi Wei Hu or Yanni Chirinos was the master of that at Durham, where he could come set at like 2 seconds left on the clock and then hold that set for however long. And it's essentially like you're having 45 seconds between pitches anyway. And you know, if you're a catcher, you can rub up the ball a little bit or do all sorts of things, but it never really did anything to the game. I don't think, I didn't feel like the games at AAA or most of AAA, we don't have AA down here except for Richmond, were impacted at all. There was a lot of worry about it. You know, you're going to get your pitchers hurt by forcing them to speed up. And it just really didn't happen. I think it's just could be another thing that is there and will eventually, kind of just become part of our collective. I think it's by far behind the automatic ball strike system in terms of impactfulness. and pervasiveness.
Right. Again, I think one of the key things is we have to see how much it's, as you just said.
And I did like the clause in the rules dump that it said it will include new regulations beyond those ones, but it didn't specify those. So I'll be very interested to see what those are before I make any judgment on them.
Again, that could go in a whole large realm of race. But the key thing I'll say with this is, here's my other really cold take, I guess. You know, there's hot takes, there's cold takes. I got a cold take, which is rules changes are part of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
They always have been. Now, there are major rules changes and there are minor ones. But when we talked about the problem that I sometimes have, and again, you have your opinion, I have mine. I'm not saying mine's any more valuable than yours. If you're listening to this and you utterly disagree with me, that's fine. But traditionalists, I would say, have effectively treated, I feel like, every rules change ever proposed in baseball as if it is something that will tear apart the fabric of the game. And we have seen, last year we saw massive rules changes. The game has survived the fact that we had extra inning speed up rules in the majors last year and 7-inning doubleheaders, and the game still functions. Those are massive. But you rewind a few years ago, and the reaction to changing the intentional walk rule to walk to first base instead of throwing four pitches out of the zone was treated as if that was this bridge too far.
And the reasons for that are so, I forget who it was, hit one of those once. Okay, so once out of ever, and you want to keep the rule in there? No, there's no reason to sit there and watch, but you know, Johnny pitcher throw four wide ones and waste everyone's time.
But the other thing with that is, and again, the collision rules were also treated that way and all that. And then these rule changes happened. And once they happened, never is it kind of noticed again. Because why? Because these rules were just not all that significant. Now, again, I'm not going to tell you that robo-umps is not significant because it is. I'm not going to tell you the shift rule is not significant because it potentially is. I'm telling you right now, the bigger bases, you won't notice it. I'm telling you right now, the pickoff rule, if you're not a left-handed pitcher, you'll probably never notice that the step-off rule, that's changed. You know, you may, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a pretty diehard fan. But these things are, in many cases, minor things. Now, at the same time, they're also minor enough that if you're Major League Baseball and the intent of these are that the game is getting too long, and when we say long, we're not talking about the amount of action. We're talking about the amount of inaction that fills out what are now a 3-hour and 10-minute game. I also don't think that these things are going to dramatically change that either. You know, that is not something that these rules will make a massive difference on either. So again, my boring take on this is, my boring opinion is, these are, I'll be interested to see what the results of these experiments are. That said, I don't see them making a massive change in most cases, one way or another.
Nope, I don't. With the caveats I've mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, no, I don't see these making a huge amount of changes. This doesn't change the way the launch angle swing will happen, I don't think. This doesn't change the value of a home run, for sure. It doesn't change the idea that any farm system wants guys who throw the heck out of the ball. I mean, unless you somehow regulate, no fastball can be thrown harder than 95 miles an hour. I don't know how you do that, but the game's not going to really change fundamentally. You might shave some time off it, but you're not going to change the philosophies right now. You are going to get some guys more hits who are, you know, dramatically shiftable these days. But other than that, it's really not anything crazy, I don't think. And some of the reactions out there are just a little overboard.
Well, but that's the world. That's okay.
That is the world. And I have,
and again, I'm not denigrating. We're not denigrating. You can have that opinion. We're not saying that you're crazy by having it, but we don't see it.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, and I don't know how, like I said at the top, like I'm divorced from fanhood of any particular team. I don't think you're particularly rooting for any particular team either. And that's an element of fanhood. We are.
But that's not what this reaction is coming from. No one is saying I hate these rules because they're going to hurt my team.
Oh, when
not these.
But 7-inning doubleheaders last year.
Not these rules. Reaction yesterday on this. These are happening at the minor league level. No one who was complaining in my timeline was saying I hate this because my San Jose Giants are going to be affected by this. Everyone who was hating this was saying, why are you trying to screw up baseball by changing it? That was right. The 99% of the response. Now, I get 95%. 5% was, I don't like this particular rule for this reason. But 95% of it was, I hate Rob Manfred. I hate how he's ruining the game.
Right. And I think, well, there's a whole spiel on that we can save for another day. But yeah, that's largely what these are. And it's almost the same to me as the reaction every time a minor league team releases an identity, which is the internet is, oh no, you're ruining it. Go back to whatever it was. This is terrible, blah, blah, blah. And then it sells like hotcakes without fail. But there's a certain sect of people who are by and large online a lot, who will react negatively to any change because they just hate change. And I think that's the kind of person we're seeing. And it's important to note too, that what you see online isn't automatically reality. It's just, you know, online.
Right. I mean, again, that's, you know, and the reality of it is that also when you see the new team name, nickname that is crazy and, you know, makes everyone gasp when they first see it and the logo and whatever. Well, the people who are reacting who hate it on social media are not in many cases what the minor league team is aiming for. Cause what they're aiming for is, you know, there's not been a team yet that has replaced a traditional logo and name with something more absurd, whatever you want to call it, that hasn't sold more hats. Right. The next one will be the first.
They're all boons to the cash register. And that's the point. It's not that the front office execs really hate, you know, the previous team name. It's that you want to, you know, juice the cash register a little bit. And this is a way to do it. I love most of them. You know, I have a lot of hats in my closet, quite frankly. And some of them are better than others. I'll give you an example. Well, this is not a permanent one, but the Carolina Mudcats did the Carolina Micro Brews last year, which I thought was an incredible play on words. Like, it was a spectacular a double entendre as I've seen in some time in the minor leagues or anywhere else. And the way they tied it into the classic Brewers uniforms was masterful. I loved it. But I also like, you know, when teams come out with silly mascots and silly names and, you know, whatever, they're all pretty fun. Some of them are whatever, but most of them are really cool, I think. But no matter what they are, there's a group of people that are going to hate them just because that's what they do.
Before we end this, I have one more question for you, Josh.
Alrighty.
What's a rule change that's not part of this that you think you'd be interested to see at least experimented with?
You wanna really break the internet? You wanna speed up the game? Here you go. Finite amount of foul balls. You can't foul off 12, 13, 14, 15 pitches and not have a strikeout. I don't know if it has to be as drastic as the third strike on a bunt, but maybe limit it to like 3 and then you have a strikeout. I guarantee you that speeds up the game. Strikeouts go through the roof because obviously, but the game gets a lot quicker. I think just as the same with pickoffs, just the interminable foul balls during certain at-bats, it does kind of follow a bell curve. Like if you have 7 foul ball at-bat, that's one thing. But if you have one of these epic, like 20 foul ball at-bats, it kind of gets entertaining.
It gets very entertaining.
But, you know, it does, okay, he threw it, it's foul. We have to call time, we have to get a new ball, we have to bring that out, do this, that, and the other thing. It does take up a lot of clock. And I know I'm sure going to get a lot of angry emails, carrier pigeons, what have you, about that. But that's another thing I was thinking of that will never happen.
I hate your rule. No offense, but I do think that that is something where that is a skill. I again, if we want to encourage better contact abilities, I want to reward the Wade Boggsian batter who can simply spoil pitch after pitch until he gets one that he can really do something with.
And it should be noted that I am among the, I don't know, not super few, but few who doesn't care about, you know, it doesn't really, the three true outcome ball doesn't bother him. My favorite player of all time, hitter at least, is Adam Dunn. So there you have it.
Okay. So now here's mine. The game has changed, much like golf courses, where, you know, if you played a modern PGA Tour event on a golf course from 1965, it would work. I think that we should change, this would be costly, change the minimum distances for the fence.
So you should move them out or in?
Out.
So you want fewer home runs?
Yes. Well, no, I don't, again, it's not because I hate home runs.
Right. I'm not getting that.
But to me, if you create more area in the outfield, that's where you encourage, by doing so, it has multiple effects. One, it will lessen the number of home runs. I still want there to be home runs, but it will lessen.
More triples.
But I want doubles and triples. Yeah. And also, I want... Again, I know that we're all products of the game that we grew up with in some ways. I love the game of the 80s. And the game of the 80s...
tangent I was going to go on.
The game of the 80s had teams. Like, you had the St. Louis Cardinals who... They were, again, we're not going to ever go back to the turf where, you know, you hit a ball into the gap and it's to the wall. I know that's never going to come back. But if you said that all of a sudden the outfield was much larger than it is now, or significantly larger, that encourages athleticism, speed in multiple ways. One, it's going to create more room for if a guy hits a ball in the gaps, a double or a triple. Well, those become more valuable. That encourages that. And two, all of a sudden, you need rangier outfielders. All of a sudden, that left fielder who doesn't cover much ground becomes a much bigger liability because that player can't get to the gap on doubles and triples. He's turning outs into extra base hits. So to me, if you said that all of a sudden we made center field 420, 425 as a minimum, and you said that down the lines, and again, I understand you're not going to be able to turn Fenway into all of a sudden it's going to be 330, 340 down the line. There are some issues with that.
But if Green Monster in the middle of the street.
Right. But if you said, though, even you said that as new stadiums are built, these are the requirements, things like that, I think it would have a pretty massive impact on the game. And the other thing I would say is I think that we need to acknowledge, much like that pitchers throw harder now, batters are stronger. And so And balls have been juicier. And so the reality of it is that if you look at how we've gone as far as building of ballparks, we've actually gone to, in most cases, smaller parks rather than larger parks in recent years. And I think a change like that could make a pretty significant impact on the game and in ways where it would encourage more balls in play, which I do think. I don't mind home runs. I don't think that it's an affront to the game or anything like that, but I do want balls in play. And doing something like that to me would positively impact balls in play.
Yeah, and I don't fault you if you want more balls in play. I don't necessarily not want more balls in play. I just think home runs are the most fun thing, especially when they're, you know, Galloian home runs.
That won't be affected by this.
I know. Or Stantonian home runs or whatever. I like home runs. I like home runs a lot. I like seeing a guy hit the ball as far as possible and throw it as hard as possible and make it bend in wicked ways more than I do singles through the right side, I guess.
But again, and I'm not even disagreeing with you like that. If all we're doing is trading home runs for singles, that's not all that exciting to me. Doubles and triples are exciting. And to me, a double and triple can be just as exciting as a home run. And so that's where I want to encourage it.
You might also get more insane catches that way too.
Yeah. Again,
those are pretty fun.
Yeah. So to me, that's the way I would do it.
And let's, if you really want to go off the wall and we really want to talk traditionalist and purist, let's go all the way back, especially for these new low A Southeast home plate umps. Back in the day, home plate umps sat in rocking chairs behind home plate. Let's get that going again.
Okay. You want to go another way? How about let's go old high school on this, you know, but this was also true way back in Major League Baseball. And like, you know what? The fence is going to be so far away that we're going to put fans in the outfield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be another way to do it. We're just not going to have an outfield wall. We're just going to have, that's really, again, that's a way changing the game too much.
Bases are actually pillows.
No, but you know, but if you actually said, you know, the outfield wall must be 500 feet from home plate. Well, all of a sudden, okay, Mark McGwire, going back a few years, may have hit that ball 430 feet, but he's really slow. So he was only able to get a double out of that. Whereas, you know, a speedster, Billy Hamilton, got the ball down the line and it kept rolling. So he got a, you know, home run out of the ball that never went more than 380 feet.
Oh, that would be absolutely wild too. How about the old substitution rule where you just had to yell out your name?
Cooper. Well, yes. I mean, now you're back in the, what, 1880s?
Well, that's where I was with the home plate umpire's chairs too.
Yes, that's true.
But if you want to be traditionalist, let's go all the way back.
Finley, you know.
Who was the player? King Kelly.
King Kelly. Yes.
But also you mentioned Finley completely by happenstance. Bring back Charlie Finley's baseball delivering rabbit to home plate.
Well, we already have, you know, that we can do right now because, you know, we already have many minor league dogs and pigs and other animals that.
Yes. And while we're at it, I don't care what has to be done. Get bat dogs in the big leagues. Do it. 30 of them. They're the best part of the minor leagues. Well, one of the best parts of the minor leagues. Bat dogs. All of them. Anyway, I would not be a JJ and the Bear podcast without mentions of bat dogs.
Yes, that is a fair part of any JJ and the Bear podcast, you know, but it's also a good way to wrap it up there, Josh.
Yes. For JJ Cooper, I'm Josh Norris. This has been a Baseball America podcast. Remember to subscribe and click on our other podcast. We've got Carlos Collazo and Ben Badler with their Future Projection podcast. We've got our college podcast every week. We've got sprinkles of JJ and the Bear every now and then. We've got all sorts of college content all the time. Pro stuff's kicking up. We're going to get that going. We've got prospect roundup every morning. Vaccinations are going up, so some of us are going to start getting out into the field sooner rather than later. And we are like 5-6 weeks away from the minor league season. So things are picking up. The quarantine is, or the pandemic is slowly going into our rearview mirror, knock wood, and things are looking up. Again, Josh Norris, JJ Cooper, Baseball America podcast. Bye.